We will now have a panel discussion, one of two panel get-togethers. This about recreating Ellington problems and rewards, that's what it's called. And I would like to see up here Dan Morgenstern, who is expected to be our chairman for this panel discussion, and also Andrew Homsey and Peter Watrous.
Ladies and gentlemen, we only have about a half an hour for this discussion, and with so many great minds at this table, I don't know how we can accomplish that. So I'll be brief. You've already met Stanley Crouch. Let me say, in addition to the introduction he received, that I would highly recommend to you a collection of essays by Mr. Crouch called Notes of a Hanging Judge. They go beyond jazz in the scope of concern, but they have the brilliance and linguistic virtuosity, which reminds me, in a sense, of an Ellingtonian approach to music. Peter Watrous is jazz critic for the New York Times, the most prestigious newspaper of the United States. He bears a great responsibility in that role, and he has handled it extremely well. Andrew Homsey is a musicologist, and among many other things, he has concerned himself a great deal with reconstruction of Ellington scores, collection of Ellington scores. He's also done yeoman work along with Gunter Schuller on the astonishing reconstruction of Charles Mingus's epitaph. Eric Wiedemann, you met this morning, and he has been our director. Eric is one of the leading jazz scholars in Europe, I would say, and perhaps we shouldn't even limit it to that. He teaches at the University of Copenhagen, and he has particularly concerned himself with a definitive compendium of Duke Ellington's compositions, and that has been something he's been working on for several years now, and which will reach its fruition fairly soon, we hope. The problem we're going to discuss, or the subject, is recreating Ellington, which is something that has been happening quite a lot since 1974. Beginning perhaps with Mercer Ellington's attempt to carry on the orchestra with the Ellington name in some form or fashion. Mercer was supposed to be with us. Those of you who read Danish have been following this in the newspapers, but he will not be with us. He has backed away, perhaps rightly so, from copying his father's work with the band. Others, however, have done so. We have in the United States, we've had the Lincoln Center Ellington recreations, which have taken place on an annual basis now for several years running. Gunter Schuller and David Baker, the Smithsonian Repertory Orchestra, have been engaged in Ellington recreations. The American Jazz Orchestra in New York City has been involved in this. In Europe, there have been a number of things, starting perhaps with Alan Cohn's reconstruction of Black, Brown, and Beige in Britain quite some years ago. So it has been a ripe field. I think what we might concern ourselves with here is the question of to what extent it is possible to recreate Ellington's music, insofar as Ellington, of course, was a great composer. And the problem in recreating jazz performances is always one of improvisation, which is kind of a shibboleth, and written note. So, well, let me start, since I have to start somewhere, let me start with Andrew Hamzy, who has worked with the written music. And let me ask you, Andy, if you feel that it is possible to recreate the brilliance, the vitality in general, whether it's possible to recreate Ellington in a meaningful way.
Well, I think recreating Ellington would fall more perhaps in the realm of molecular physics, perhaps. And but to be very serious about this, I think in the way that I've been moving in terms of my studies, I think the important issue is interpreting Ellington, and that becomes a problem of, first of all, getting notation, scores on one hand, and getting musicians capable of playing the spirit of the music and maintaining their own individuality. I've prepared a short 3-minute collage, which I would like you to consider for a moment. Imagine you have in front of you an orchestra of 16 musicians, and they are expected to interpret Ellington. This collage will show some of the problems and at the same time some of the rewards that would be inherent in that interpretation.
Thank you.
And so we've asked these 16 musicians to play that scope of music from the 1920s to the 1970s. Those examples, I focused, I could have done a million different collages. That one focuses mainly on the brass instruments in Ellington's orchestra and the rhythm section. It shows an incredible scope of rhythmic ideas and brass tonalities. It shows the imagination, the creativity that Ellington used in approaching his orchestra. And I think I could just sum this up by saying that any director, any group of musicians that would get together to play Ellington's music have a daunting task ahead of them, but as I said before, perhaps the problems are the rewards in interpreting this great music. Thank you, Dan.
Thank you. Let me ask Peter, when you have to review an Ellington-oriented performance, do you judge it, what kind of criteria do you use? Do you judge it against the standard of Ellington himself, or do you look at it more like what amount of originality has been invested in it, or is it a matter of what the performance aims at?
I'm actually open to all sorts of different interpretations. I mean, I don't see how a faithful interpretation, in other words, faithful to the recording, which I think is pretty much the standard, since most people know recordings and not the sheet music, I don't see how a faithful recording would be any more valuable than maybe a radical reinterpretation. I mean, I think that they're all interesting, and I don't have an ideological a standard that I hold against it. I think that you don't get reinterpretations for the most part, you get interpretations, and I think that that's what we're hearing. And I think that's because right now the repertory movement is actually fairly new. In other words, the things that the organizations that you've mentioned have really just come up in the last 5 years almost. And I think it's going to be fascinating to see what happens in the next 20 years when the takes on Ellington become a little bit more Catholic and people become more expansive in their interpretations. I want to just digress a little bit and say that I think that Ellington, that at least from our perspective in New York, and I think Stanley agrees with me on this, that jazz is undergoing a renaissance right now, and I don't know what you all think about it from your perspectives, but I think that Ellington has been extremely important in that. I think that one of the main elements of the Renaissance is the repertory movement, and I think that one of the reasons that the repertory movement has worked is because of Ellington. I think, actually, as difficult as it is from a musical perspective to reproduce Ellington, I think Ellington, in a way, comes across better in concert than, for instance, Count Basie or Lunsford or somebody like that, because the actual voicings of the music are so distinct and can be played that you do get an idea of the sonic richness of Ellington. I think that a badly played piece of Ellington is a lot more interesting than a badly played piece of Count Basie, for example, even though it is technically easier to play a Count Basie piece than it is an Ellington piece in a lot of respects. Certainly harmonically, it's a lot richer. And I think that Ellington's vision is intrinsic to the music more than a lot of other composers.
Eric, you played this morning, among other things, a version of the Mooch by Pierre Dorgue's band. And you are someone who, in addition to having a great knowledge of the entire jazz tradition, is also very interested in contemporary jazz. Do you have any feelings about how Ellington's legacy can best be used in today's jazz?
Well, I must say that the repertory movement, I do have my reservations there. I very much respect the the dedication behind it and the love of the music that is behind it. But to me, recreating Ellington has the one problem always that if you listen to a recreated Coco, I at least will immediately have the 1940 Ellington Coco running in my head, and it'll be very difficult for me, even with some very dedicated and very good musicians, to hear anything that would approach what Ellington did in 1940. I think that it's even historically impossible. And I think that in a way, recreating Ellington in a way is treating the Ellington compositions as if they're just repertoire which everybody can play in a spirit of imitating the way they were done originally. It has the advantage that it can be done live today, and it can be done in better fidelity in quite a few cases. But you still have the problem of comparing them to Ellington's own I wouldn't say interpretations of his own music, but to the realizations of his music, where his way of playing them is every bit as much the composition as something which may or may not exist anymore on paper. And talking about that Pierre Durer record, what I like about that is that it takes a piece of Ellington and it takes something of the Ellington tradition and uses it in a personal way. It doesn't try to recreate Ellington. That's what I think is important, that recreation, well, to me, is not a very important thing to do with Ellington. He did it better than anyone else can hope to do it. And the idea to use him today, to use his music today, is to approach it in a very personal way, not with any hope of recreating anything, but in the hope of building on what he gave us and make something different with it. That's my main point.
I was going to set this up, really, in a way, because Stanley Crouch, among other things, is an advisor to the Lincoln Center Classical Jazz Concert Series. And in that series, we have heard some fairly remarkable, really what I would call recreations of Ellington's music. So I would ask Stanley, he can talk about anything, of course, that he would like to talk about in respect to what we have discussed, but specifically in response to what Eric just said, how do you feel about actually getting close to replicating the music?
Well, I think that I understand what he's saying, and I've heard it before, and I don't really find it significant in terms of what the problem is of addressing the work of an artist in public performance. I mean, Duke Ellington is dead. Cootie Williams is dead. Harry Carney is dead. Are they to exist forever only on recordings? Because if we use that argument, then, like if they had invented the phonograph in 1650, then there would be people who would probably say, well, I mean, why the hell do Mozart? We've got his version of him playing it. It seems, what I think happens is that, when we did Such Sweet Thunder and the score from Anatomy of a Murder, the effect in a hall of a well-rehearsed band, the moment that they say, boom, bi-dip-dop-deep, I mean, there's something that goes down in there about the music as music that is separate from the fact that the people for whom it was originally written are no longer with us, and separate from the fact that an extraordinarily fine recording of that exists. Because as great as that Duke Ellington recording is, to me, if you get as a recording, now I'm not, people may think this is sacrilegious, but in a hall with a live band playing that to me sounded better in Alice Tully Hall with that live sound projected into the air sounded better than the record of Duke Ellington playing it to me as a sound. Now, I'm not, now if we go back and say, oh, well, wait a minute, are you saying that Kenny Washington sounded better than Sam Woodyard? That's not what I'm saying. See, I don't know a record that sounds better than a live band. Now, perhaps Eric does. I have yet to hear that. You know, I mean, one of the things is, if you heard Ellington in person, none of his records sounded as good as he sounded in person, to me. I mean, on the nights when I heard that band Red Hot, I'm sorry. I mean, I got I'm a minor Duke Ellington collector. I have about 200 albums. And none of them sounded like him, just his sound at the piano on that bandstand. You know, Paul Gonzalez, there's no record they made sounded like that. You know, because there's something about music, the presence of music in the flesh is something that's an entity that we have to address. Now, what we're trying to do is we're trying to do two things. Some performances are played the way they were played on the recordings. Others, people make up, they do their own improvisations. And as we know from listening to many, many different versions of Duke Ellington's recordings, none of his pieces really stayed static anyway. I mean, the moment that he puts Paul Gonzalez up on Cottontail, something else happens to Cottontail that did not happen with Ben Webster up there. And if Paul didn't play on a given night and he'd appointed it Harold Ashby, then something would become something else then too. And so part of the thing we have to address is that as I was saying in the totally unprepared paper that I delivered, the person to whom you point at, if you are a band leader, that's part of the way you want that piece developed on that particular occasion. Now, what happens too when you do a show in which you take, as we've done before, where you take a specific thing like Ellington and Train, so you start with Choo Choo and you come through another piece, a Daybreak Express, and another piece in the 40s, another piece in the 50s, end up with Loco Mighty. There's an incredible effect that has on an audience too, just to hear his brain, the way that his mind as a creative force worked when you sit there and you hear 50 years of dealing with something. If you take an Ellington blues from the 20s and go and follow blues themes throughout, if you do Afro-Hispanic type stuff. I mean, and the other part is the other thing is very, very important, it seems to me, for musicians playing Duke Ellington is what they are forced to learn. You see, one of the fundamental problems with the development of jazz outside of, say, Ellington's band itself and what Charles Mingus would demand of the people who came into his band is that most jazz musicians only knew the style that they grew up playing, you know, which to me, in terms of aesthetic depth in each player, is disastrous. I mean, okay, obviously, because for instance, Charlie Parker could play more styles than the style that he became famous playing, you know, because he'd had to play them in dance bands in Kansas City, in Harlan Leonard's band, et cetera, et cetera. Now, a lot of people focus on him, and we look at somebody like John Coltrane, who was the last extremely great modern jazz player, all jazz is modern, but say post Charlie Parker player, we hear this guy effectively playing with Tad Dameron, with Thelonious Monk, with Duke Ellington, with Miles Davis. See, John Coltrane represents what a jazz musician really should be. And that's the way people became, that's what people became when they came in Duke Ellington's band. They became real jazz musicians. And when guys come in who think, you know, and Andrew's seen this, and I'm sure you've seen it too, Eric, if you see these guys trying to rehearse those pieces, they come in going, They find some out, you know, because, I mean, you think playing like Cootie Williams is easy when you hear him play it. When you pick the plunge up and you got to find out that you find the difference between that half inch of the plunger being one place and another, that you got to figure out exactly where that is. And there's no book you can go to that says, take the plunger and put it here and then move it three and three quarters inches when you will get a certain kind of a G. That's not what's going to happen. You got to go home and learn something. And I think that the effect that it has on the player, finally, the effect on the audience. And see, people who are like, say, 35 or something, who were 15 years old or so when Duke Ellington died, they never heard the band. And I'll tell you this, if you on a good night, anybody's band playing Duke Ellington's music, if people sit there in front of that for 2 hours, when they get up, they're different people than they were when they came in there. And Duke Ellington's not just some guy they've seen little snippets of on some clip from the Tonight Show or something like that.
I would add to that that the performance of Such Sweet Thunder that Stanley referred to, I was lucky to be there. And I'm old enough to have been present when the band performed that in its prime. And of all the recreations of Ellington music that I've witnessed, that was the most remarkable one, because there was a point there where I closed my eyes and I really felt that it was almost like the band was there again. And so that's the degree to which it's possible to do that, but it isn't always possible. And we should keep in mind too, is one thing that hasn't been mentioned, is that Ellington himself, of course, constantly changed his approach to what we might call the Ellington repertoire. Caravan in 1947 is completely different from Caravan in 1937, and again in the 60s, something altogether different. So I think that when we approach Ellington's music, we have a certain amount of freedom in how to deal with it, because he himself took a great deal of liberty with it. He certainly was not someone who believed, like Benny Goodman did, that an arrangement once performed should continue to be performed the same way. I think what we can do here, if we have a few minutes left, is to take some questions from the audience, if you want to direct them at some member of the panel specifically or just in general. But make sure that we can hear you. Reuben Jackson?
I thought I was going to have to come down front like they do on Truth or Consequences or something. Yeah. My question actually is for Mr. Crouch, and it's pertaining to something you said in your earlier statement. Let me digress for a minute and say I think you, as Mr. Morgenstern said, I'm really fond of your writing. I really like, even when I disagree, my wife's here, I say, listen to this stuff, I wish I could say this. But with that said, I'm curious about a statement you made pertaining to Ellington's mixing of the high and low, as you put it, and keeping an ear to the street. I couldn't help think of the article you wrote for the New Republic about Miles Davis, and the fact that on the one hand, you celebrate Ellington for having an approach and listening to what was going on in his time, but after a certain period in Miles Davis's development, you were, well, to be kind, you were slightly denigrating what he was doing here of late. And just, if you could just address that for just a second, please. Thank you.
Oh, well, now you want me to talk about Duke Ellington or about Miles Davis?
I guess the concept, because as I said, I listened to you say that and I thought, well, now here's a guy who said one thing about one artist, and then on the other hand, was not to your liking.
Right. No, well, see, I my fundamental argument was this, was that, see, the, the whole pearls before swine proposition, if somebody throws some pearls over there in a pig pen, now there's a difference between going over there and getting the pearls out of the pig pen, which are clearly going to be dirty now, because they've been in there with them pigs and what pigs do and the way pigs are. Now, to get the pearls out of the pig pen and wash them off, right, and present them is one thing. To get over there and to lie down with the pigs and put them on, say, your chest and cover yourself up with more mud with the pigs is the difference that I'm talking about, see. I think that because what the point I was making is that the honky tonks, the gambling dens, and all of those places where a lot of those little chants and sometimes some blues lyrics and stuff came out of is one thing, but we can't confuse those things, those places, with what somebody like Scott Joplin did when he put that together with something else that he understood, you see. And the thing is that when I say high and low, what I mean is that there is a certain vitality of a sort, energy-wise, to the street. Just like even at its worst, I guess rap music, if you will, has a certain kind of force to it. But a guy who's been, see, I've been in race riots and stuff too, in gang fights, and they have energy too. So the question becomes, can we say something is important just because of its energy? Seems to me that what a great artist does is that he takes that kind of energy and gives it a certain kind of a refinement and elevates it from a barbaric state. And I feel that Miles Davis succumbed to the barbarism of post Jimi Hendrix pop music and did not elevate it in most instances. And I did give one instance where I think he did in Mademoiselle Mabry, where he actually took something from Jimi Hendrix and really made it into something that I thought was first-class, innovative-sounding jazz. Well, I think that's always what it ultimately is, isn't it? You know. But there's one thing I wanted to say, too, though, about something else. See, I don't like the term recreation, because recreation, it seems to me, which is, I think, what Andrew meant when he was saying stuff about molecular physics. See, because recreation seems to me removes the possibility that something artistic is taking place, you know. And it seems to me that the big job in a performance is not just to be well rehearsed, but to achieve artistic coherence, to achieve the momentum of an artistic event. And when you do that, the music sounds as though it's being played right then for the first time. I mean, I think that's what any fine band does. I mean, I don't care how many times you heard Thelonious Monk play Epistrophe. On a night when he was really playing, it actually seemed as though that's the first time Epistrophe was played, the first time you ever heard it, and it never swung like that, even if you thought you heard it before. It seems to me that what the best of the repertory bands is trying to do is to get that. See, it's not, you don't want to just go away with somebody saying, oh, you sure did sound like Cootie Williams, you know. I mean, good, you know, but that's not the point. The point is, because see, there are people who didn't play well, who kind of sounded like Cootie Williams, or sounded a lot like Cootie Williams, but they may not have had Cootie Williams artistry. They may have mastered certain things on the plunger, but they couldn't be put in a certain situation for 32 bars or something and create an artistic event. And it seems to me that when somebody like Joe Temperley, when he stands up and picks up the baritone, and this guy is from Scotland, the sound he gets, the feeling he has for the artistry of Harry Carney, not the imitation of Harry Carney, but the artistry of Harry Carney, something comes out when he plays that is very, very unusual. And to dismiss it, say this is a recreation of Harry Carney, I think is to truly miss the true greatness of what Harry Carney did.
We'll take one more question.
He wasn't talking to you.
Yeah, I'd like to make two comments. One is on things that Stanley said. I remember just a year or two ago in. The orchestra did the recreation of the New Orleans Suite, and one of the most interesting things that they did was that they put in the soprano saxophone played, I believe it was by Norris Turney, on the portrait of Sidney Bechet, right. And that's the way it was originally written. And of course, Duke, when Johnny Hodges died, had to suddenly substitute Paul Gonzalez. So this is a very fascinating thing that reinterpretation can do. And the other thing, and this is now directed to Andrew Holmesy, is that Andrew has done something that he and Lauren Schoenberg and several other people, they have actually gone into the archives and dug out things that Ellington did which he never recorded. And this is the only way we'll ever get a chance to hear Concerto for Clinkers and Bessie and some of these other things, which are now have been heard.
That being a statement from Morris Hedera rather than a question, I think gives us the opportunity, regretfully, to conclude this panel. And I want to thank Stanley Crouch, Peter Watrous, Andrew Homsey, and Eric Wiedemann, and you, ladies and gentlemen.